Themes of storytelling and the ethics of fiction translate to the cinematic medium. How, I will ask, is Briony's problematic rewriting of the past in Atonement conserved in the film and expressed in cinematic terms, focusing particularly on the use of intradiegetic sound and music? Special attention will be paid to how questions of predestination and anticipation in the first part of the novel are rendered cinematically, as well as issues related to fiction and reality within the film world. I will also consider whether the film successfully avoids the pitfalls of costume drama and the British heritage industry with an analysis of melodrama and nostalgia in the film. In this vein, I will also be asking how the film treats the novel's rewriting of the national myths of Dunkirk and the home front. Okay, firstly, we must address the film's status as adaptation. Much critical theory surrounding adaptation seems to gravitate around twin notions of specificity and fidelity. The latter has largely been rejected as a critical tool for analysing film. After all, how can a film be faithful to its source material when its means of expressions are largely very, very different? But this position could lead to a further dogma, which is to say that the only useful way of analysing adaptation is through an analysis of those elements which are specific to its medium, like editing and camera work. And this taps into a longer or an older debate in film studies. For example, V.F. Perkins argued that systematically emphasising the cinema's properties as a visual medium neglects or denigrates the aspects which the movie shares with other narrative forms. To focus on editing and camera work alone is to neglect other parts of a film's discourse. Most critics in adaptation studies now prefer to talk in terms of intertextuality and the dialogic relationship between a film and other works. This is certainly an appropriate approach to Joe Wright's Atonement, given the nature of the source material. But Matthew Bolton takes the argument a little bit further, suggesting that we must not, nevertheless, neglect the most important intertext of all, which is the source material. And it's, after all, the only thing that really distinguishes adaptation studies from textual study in general. It is therefore possible to assess a film's effects both in terms of specificity, and fidelity, its uniquely cinematic solutions to foregrounding and, indeed, dialoguing with many of the preoccupations of the source novel. Much attention has been paid to the film's soundtrack, and in particular the use of a typewriter in the score. Indeed, the film won an Oscar for its original soundtrack. Most of the praise has rightly focused on the way that this unconventional scoring harnesses the novel's metafictional discourse on rewriting, how the events of the past are subject to later narrativization by the elderly Briony looking back on the crime for which she's impelled to atone. Arguably less attention has been paid, however, to the effect this has on the film's narrative and how it might serve the novel's ethical dimension on rewriting of national myths. The film's opening scene sets the tone. The words Atonement are typewritten in white block capitals onto a black screen, the keystrokes and carriage returns emphatically audible. This is followed by a shot of a doll's house, while the camera then pans back to show assorted animals, toy animals, laid out on a child's bedroom floor. The speed of the pan seems to trace the increasingly rhythmic sound of the keys being struck. The typewriting continues as Briony is shown to be putting the finishing touches to her manuscript, The Trials of Arabella. Another repeated keystroke, this time that of a piano, joins the score, and we sense that the typewriting has a rhythm to it to which other sonic elements are starting to coalesce. As Briony leaves the room, the keystrokes have become a steady percussion, the progressive forward movement of which is matched by Briony's purposeful striding through the house. What is key to these establishing shots is that the typewriter serves to accentuate and, moreover, to accelerate the action. Film music is most commonly and conventionally used to accentuate what we see on screen, often artificially guiding our responses. And yet there's nothing innately naturalistic about it. As Robert Stamm explains, all film sound which is not immediately anchored in the image is by definition anti-illusionistic, but its function in guiding viewer response and oiling the wheels of narrative continuity have become so conventional as to seem naturalistic. Joe Wright's Atonement seems to play with this very paradox. The use of the typewriter both underscores a sense of suspense, for example, as it might do in traditional scoring, while at the same time drawing attention to its unconventional components. The first typewriting we hear is, after all, anchored in the image. That is, of course, unless we assume that the rendering of the title, Atonement, before the opening scene, is actually attributable to the 77-year-old Bryony recounting events years later. Curiously, however, it's not just the typewriter that is percussive. In these opening scenes, a number of other intradiegetic sounds also fall into the rhythm of the music. Doors slam shut, we hear footsteps, we see the domestic staff billowing the sheets. It all falls into a time. Everything is in step and synchronized. One way of interpreting this oddly choreographed vision of the world is that we are being offered something of Bryony's perspective here, the love of order and symmetry that derives from and informs her early literary efforts and, of course, her accusation of Robbie. We could also call this a visual expression of Carl Jung's theory of synchronicity or meaningful coincidence, a kind of clicking into gear where the events around us seem to fall into a significant pattern. This is important for two reasons. Firstly, we learn, as in the novel, that what we are seeing is an event in the distant past, the significance of which has already been established. Almost all cinema presupposes a meaningful exposition of events to some greater narrative end. But here, in part due to the typewriter, the effect, of course, is self-reflexive. The film is not disguising the relationship between its own momentum and the written constructs of narrative. Now, this is the cinematic way that Joe Wright and Christopher Hampton chose to render one of the overlooked characteristics of the first part of the novel, namely the proleptic allusions to the future. Some of these allude to the narrating instance of Bryony's final draft some six decades later, while elsewhere Bryony refers forward to her crime, which creates at once a sense of anticipation, but also a framing distance. We are alerted to the fact of that something of significance is going to happen, but simultaneously asked to consider it as something of a done deal, akin to predestination. In terms of cinematic discourse, the accentuating and distancing effects of the music could be said to parallel the posthumous ironies posited by Cecilia, that her sensation that all of the events of the day had already happened a long time ago and that all outcomes were already in place. Cecilia's feeling of déjà vu is, of course, attributable to the hidden narrator within the novel, or at least this part of the novel, that is Bryony. But such authorial asides also produce an effect of fatedness and predestination on the characters. As we've seen, Robbie puts on his dinner jacket, he brushes his hair, and we sense this odd clicking into gear. He strikes his Zippo light, or he puts the letter away. All these intradiegetic sounds are conventionally accentuated, but very, very synchronous. Okay, the camera follows him leaving the room to audible footsteps with the same forward drive as we saw with Bryony in the first scenes. And as we see him walking along the path, we can perhaps consider that he's thinking about time. As in the sequence of the novel, Robbie reflects that his shoes rapped loudly on the surface of the road like a giant clock. And he made himself think about time. He had never before felt such appetite, such impatience for the story to begin. Robbie's taking the wrong letter engages him into a pattern of events beyond his control, expressed cinematically through the rhythmic undercurrent of sound. To borrow a cliché, his fate with the letter is signed, sealed, and delivered. Moreover, Robbie's nervous yet pleasurable anticipation of the evening are underwritten with a cruel irony. In the novel, this is expressed as his dreams for the future, in the film as an inexorable movement towards a series of fated events. Like the giant clock of Robbie's imagination, the clock is ultimately ticking on his life. That he encounters Bryony en route, thrashing destructively at some shrubs to this same rhythm, is no coincidence. It is, after all, the recklessness of her fabulations that will have such a detrimental effect on his life. Incidentally, when he hands Bryony the letter, and we didn't get to hear this, we hear the buzz of a fly or wasp, which echoes similar intrusions elsewhere, most overtly in the scene by the fountain as it is witnessed by Bryony from the upstairs window. In this earlier scene, the wasp seems to signify different forms of entrapment. Firstly, that of Cecilia and Robbie, who are transformed in more ways than one into characters in another person's story, but also Bryony herself, who, like a wasp, is struggling against like a wasp struggling against a window, is trapped by the illusion of an unmediated reality. While the wasp cannot fathom the surface that blocks its path, Bryony cannot see the true nature of the dumb show in the garden below. And also, like a wasp, and to borrow another cliche, there is a sting to Bryony's tale, spelt T-A-L-E. Her fabulations have a tremendous real-life consequence, which we mustn't lose sight of when considering Atonement's ethics, even in the light of its play of realities. Okay, so another important function of the music is the way that it adds a modern sensibility to period drama. Joe Wright has established a career on the back of highbrow literary adaptation, with Atonement bracketed by his version of Pride and Prejudice, and in 2012, Anna Karenina. There was always a risk that the working title production would be heavy on period nostalgia and light on the source novel's more complex themes. For most first-time viewers, and certainly those unfamiliar with the novel, the splendour of the locations will act as signifiers for heritage cinema, which has become a pejorative byword for, as John Coffey argued, a nostalgic cinema suffused with the charm of manners and costume and basking in the warm glow of the past. Certainly, in Joe Wright's Atonement, we find ourselves a long way from the Talis House of the novel, in which McEwan was at pains to represent as an ugly place with a bright red facade. This is glossed over in the film, something that illustrates the commercial interest in shooting at grand heritage locations, which, of course, helps sell movies in the UK and overseas. Some critics have argued that Wright deliberately undermines these heritage signifiers by highlighting the theatricality of the country house. The opening shot of the doll's house is echoed later with a similar shot of Talis House, which reveals the toy to be a replica. Like the animals amassed on the bedroom floor, Bryony and Cecilia are shown from above as tiny figures lying on the lawn. For those initiated to the narrative through the novel, we might grasp the insinuation that what we are seeing is a mise-en-scène of the day's events by Bryony, the narrator, some six decades later. It is interesting to note that Joe Wright made his name not just with Pride and Prejudice, but earlier he started in the filmmaking business having produced visuals for rave events. The synchronous nature or synchronous character of the film and its sound design might owe a debt to this more contemporaneous interest in the interlockings of sound and image. The score's propulsive percussion, even if a typewriter itself is hardly modern, infuses the film with a dynamism that serves as a counterpoint to the film's heritage conventions. I think the film thus shares some DNA with Robert Altman's film Gosford Park, which also investigates heritage or costume cinema from the inside out, that is to say, by playfully critiquing while not entirely disavowing the genre. Such a self-reflexive subset of costume drama could be considered what Frederick Jameson refers to as a cinema of post-nostalgia, in which, quote, a properly allegorical processing of the past becomes possible. Much as in Altman's film, Joe Wright's metafictional strategies largely stop the film from wallowing in period nostalgia and also engage with the way in which we represent the past. The propulsive or rhythmic undercurrent to the sound design also bookends the section which represents Bryony's experiences as a nurse in London. This sequence begins with a typewriter underscoring a shot of nurses being led through the corridors of a hospital, marching in unison behind the ward sister in a quasi-military fashion, the clump, clump of their footsteps and the keystrokes virtually synchronous. Here, a new element of discourse is introduced, and an important one for the novel too. Part of Bryony's Atonement consists of eschewing university to work as a nurse, and parallels are established between the dehumanizing discipline and impersonality of this work with that of the military. The section ends with Bryony returning from a visit to her sister and Robbie's post-war home, of course an event that never really happened. As the camera pans towards Bryony, seated in an underground train carriage, that familiar hammering keystroke resumes. Even if we are alerted here to the act of writing, we are surely not to interpret this as some attempt to undermine the veracity of what we saw of hospital life in earlier scenes. Here, the emphasis is rather on Bryony's need to relate not just her wartime experiences, but the sacrifices and traumas of the home front in general, and particularly those of women. Just as the myths of Dunkirk need to be rewritten, the home front deserves greater attention in the popular imagination. We could argue that the film thus retains something of the book's gradual distancing from the pastoral unworldliness of the country house novel. In McEwan's novel, the relative isolation of Talis House, as described in the first part, succumbs to the social transformations of the period, notably when working-class Londoners are evacuated there for their safety during the Blitz. Although the lavishness of the location shoot in the first part of the film could open it to accusations of a nostalgia for a time of more settled class distinctions, the retention of the broader story of Bryony's redemption, or lack thereof, is important. Bryony's implication in Dunkirk through nursing and her rejection of Oxbridge in both novel and film represent not only a form of atonement for her crime, but also penance for her privilege. The fact that Robbie and Cecilia die, respectively, at Dunkirk and in the Blitz is significant. As historian David Kinnison argues, these two events above all led to an aggressive mood demanding fair shares for all and social reforms of a universalist egalitarian nature, namely the creation of the welfare state. The question of heritage nostalgia has implications for the war sequence. We could argue that the virtuoso steadicam shot in Dunkirk, in the Dunkirk section, is in itself maybe a little dishonest due to its modernist aesthetics, and therefore a repetition of Bryony's own stylistic evasions. For example, Laura Bolger has talked about the epic tableau shown with kind of little patriotic strokes, the soldiers singing on the bandstand, which maybe fails to convey some of the bitterness of the portrait of Dunkirk in the novel. In particular, she evokes the soldiers singing of the White Cliffs of Dover, popularized by Vera Ling, even though it was written after the events described in the film. While I concur that the tone of the sequence is less embittered than that of the novel, in which the collapse of morale and authority is more pronounced, there is no doubt that the film's project to rewrite the national myth of Dunkirk, which somehow transformed in the popular imagination a military catastrophe into a victory. If Wright exchanges the harsher realism of the Dunkirk section for more dreamlike qualities, we could argue that this is intended to reflect Robbie's delirious state of mind as he slowly dies from septicemia. In the novel, Robbie also refers a number of times to the dreamlike and nightmarish qualities of the war, and McEwan also focuses on the hellish carnival atmosphere of the beach resort, and as it is appropriated by a marauding and demoralized British expeditionary force. Yet these surreal touches, despite these surreal touches, there's still a preoccupation with truth-telling that runs through the narrative. As in the book, and as in her final television confession, lies matter, and so does the truth. It's worth pointing out that Joe Wright has expressed an affection for English melodrama of the type typified by David Lean's Brief Encounter, as evidenced in scenes when the film does indeed flirt with sentimentality and mawkishness. An argument could be made that such moments somehow constitute Bryony's melodramatic reimagining of the moment, something that could also be said about the scene in which Bryony visits Cecilia in London after the war. As Bryony leaves the house, the camera pans away from the building as the couple are seen through the window in a passionate embrace, with the curtains billowing suggestively. The signifiers once again point to classic melodrama, but the illusion is quickly pierced here. We learn from Bryony minutes later that this is the happy ending that Bryony wanted for the couple, but we don't need to take it literally. This does not render the melodrama unproblematic, however, as it belies the elderly Bryony's passage to more serious literary forms. Are we not supposed to believe, for example, that Bryony left behind such clichés along with her childhood trials of Arabella at Talis House? Others have linked these moments of melodrama to more self-reflexive scenes in the film, such as when Robbie stumbles almost inexplicably into the cinema during the Dunkirk sequence. He sort of meanders across the screen where Le Quai des Brumes, a French film, a very sort of melodramatic, romantic French film, is playing, and he kind of touches the screen. Now, I'm going to sort of move ahead a little bit. I think it's not just a sort of a means for McEwan to replace a lot of the allusion in the novel to cinematic modes. I think here also there's an emphasis on the dreams that Robbie cannot fulfill, the fact that he is unable to realize many of his sensual fantasies of Cecilia. He talks about how, he quotes Shakespeare, the full prospect of his hopes will never be realized. But like this, the wasp struggling against the window, the screen is, the cinema screen is for him a kind of a dead end, signifying his own struggle against an illusion, namely that his life will just simply resume after the war. And he talks a lot about my life will resume, my life will resume. It will never resume. Okay, now I need to go straight to the end. There's been a lot of debate. It was interesting. I was talking to Harold, and he had similar feelings to me. At the end of the film, you see the sequence of Robbie and Cecilia reunited in this kind of cottage by these white cliffs. Now, some critics have suggested this represents kind of an alternative reality, like you can choose between the two. Now, for me, there's a very, very important signifier in the film that we mustn't overlook, and that is the postcard that this image derives from. This whole sequence seems to derive from this postcard image that is on a postcard that Cecilia gives him and kind of is a promise for a future that they'll have together. Now, for me, this final sequence is not some kind of alternative reality, like we can just choose any reality we want. It's a kind of bittersweet reminder of not just what Robbie and Cecilia have lost, but that many people have lost through conflict. And I want to kind of just end on this point. I mean, there's a lot of things that I haven't really had a chance to say, but I think it's important that I mention that despite the metafictional discourse, I think the truth does matter. If it didn't, then Bryony's lies would not matter. Bryony's lies do matter. And the point is that, okay, she talks in the novel about the fact that why does everything have to be my fault? Couldn't it also be the war's fault? Yes, she's right. It can be the war's fault too. But I think the most important thing is that we keep sight of this idea that, yes, our access to the past may be problematized. The fact that we have to narrate in order to access the past is always problematic. But that's not to say that all these realities are in some way relativized, that we can just choose freely between them. Bryony lied, and she made a catastrophic mistake, and I think that is the core of the novel's ethical position. And I think I better stop on that. Okay, thank you very much.